You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local 41 and United Auto Workers Local 249. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. And United Auto Workers, Local 249, members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. You need to listen to tonight's show before you click on Amazon.com to find the perfect gifts this holiday season. Hope you haven't done it already. You'll find out how poor working conditions, unfair competition, and billions in the tax incentives have made Amazon the Walmart of the internet. We'll first talk with... We're first going to talk with Sam Nelson from Jobs with Justice about their wish list for Amazon's new headquarters and then how the company treats its employees. Then we'll ask Olivia LaVecchia about Amazon's appetite for your tax dollars. In the news, it's working people on the front lines in Honduras protesting a stolen election. And our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with attorney Angie Williams. Now for the news.
The Detroit Free Press reports that the UAW president, Dennis Williams, condemned Ford Motor Company's strategy to remove production of the electric vehicles from Michigan to Mexico and noted the silence of President Donald Trump on Ford's recent announcement. Williams said, "I'm angry at Ford. It has an opportunity to do something for the state of Michigan and the United States of America. People in Mexico are not going to buy electric vehicles, and we desperately need high-paying jobs and technology here. I mean, 7% of the vehicle cost is labor. How much do they need to make in profits?" Earlier this month, it said it planned to build vehicles in Mexico. Last year, amid pressure from Trump to keep his jobs in the U.S., the company said it would build electric vehicles at its Flat Rock plant south of Detroit. The plan is to produce self-driving vehicles at Flat Rock while building traditional cars there as well. Williams continued, "I get up and try to figure out where the administration is headed. Look at the tax plan. It gives corporations an incentive to outsource." He said the tax plan actually undermines Trump's plan for NAFTA renegotiation to keep more jobs in the U.S. Williams said our leaders have an unprecedented disregard for working families, and he cannot understand why America has no industrial policy. "We've got to have a higher level of education to meet the next generation of technology," he said. "We're being left behind for a lot of greed." Williams has completely dismissed the idea that tax cuts for the rich and corporations will lead them to create more jobs.
In recent weeks, there have been many revelations of sexual harassment in the entertainment industry and Congress as the Me Too movement spreads, but many want to know whether harassment was still a huge problem among women in less prestigious jobs. It turns out it's bad. A chart recently published by the Center for American Progress highlights just how pervasive sexual harassment is for workers in every corner of the workforce. Low-wage service industry jobs dominated by women, particularly women of color, and industries where men have historically outnumbered women, appear to be particularly susceptible. Utilizing a decade's worth of data from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the federal agency responsible for enforcing laws against employment discrimination, Vox News, and the Center for American Progress delved into more than 85,000 charges of sexual harassment to decipher where the issue is most prevalent and for whom. Leading the complaints is accommodation and food services with 14.23% of the complaints, but only 7.2% of the workforce. Next is retail trade with 13.4% of claims and 10.9% of the workforce. Then there's manufacturing with 11.7% of the claims, but where women workers are historically scarce. And since we're already talking about Ford, last August it settled a sexual and racial harassment claim for over $10 million at its Chicago assembly plant and the Chicago stamping plant, where now decades-old laws against harassment were apparently ignored.
If you listen to Democracy Now! On KKFI, you know that there is a crisis in Honduras which has put working people, farmers, and the poor in great danger. As tanks, military, and police occupy the streets armed to the teeth with the latest in U.S. equipment, the resistance to a stolen election grows. So far, there are numerous dead and the number is rising. According to one leader of a worker center in the town of Choloma, blood is flowing in the streets. They're killing people like they're some kind of vermin. The protesters are saying that the presidential election on November 26 was stolen, and also that President Juan Orlando Hernandez illegally ran for re-election, even though the Constitution forbids a president to serve more than one term. Since Hernandez has complete control of all branches of government, including the Election Commission, the only recourse people have is to protest in the streets, and mostly peaceful mass protests have spread to every corner of the country. The Organization of American States has called for a new election because of so much evidence of fraud, but the Trump administration is on the verge of certifying Hernandez as the winner. Democrats in Congress, led by Senator Patrick Leahy and Representative Keith Ellison, are trying to stop Trump's State Department and calling for a withholding of the millions of aid we send to Honduras, allegedly to stamp out narco trafficking. This morning, Ellison published a letter which was signed by several dozen congresspersons, including Representative Emmanuel Cleaver. It said, "We believe that the Honduran people have a right to peaceful protest, and we're alarmed at the actions of Honduran security forces. Since November 28th, when the vote count took a dramatic and improbable turn in favor of President Hernandez, Honduran security forces have continued to fire live ammunition at civilians who are protesting electoral fraud. Honduran human rights groups have documented at least 23 protesters and bystanders killed to date, with at least 12 deaths at the hands of state security forces. In addition, reports indicate that over 1,500 people have been illegally detained. Reports of beatings, torture, and arbitrary detentions are widespread. We urge you to make clear the Honduran government that these abuses must cease immediately. For more information, see the Honduras Solidarity Network on Facebook." And the news tonight was read by Aaron Blockman, Ariana Eckel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
It happened again last night. It happens every time I play. When the gig is over, someone has to say a question that appears to be on everybody's brains as they're driving down the highway. In the commuter lanes, it sure is not just me, it's the 99% of artists who are wondering about the thousands they just spent on a CD that will never make it on the air. Now all of us are grown-ups here, we know life isn't fair, but the answer to the question is one I'd also like to know. Why don't they play you on the radio? Why don't they play you on the radio? Perhaps my songs are too cerebral. They don't make you dance. My melodies are boring. There's no spandex in my pants. Maybe it's because I don't use a drum machine. Maybe I'm too red just don't want to hear it. They don't want to analyze anything more complex than the space between your thighs. Maybe I should wear more glitter, go to parties and an egg. Perhaps I need to go electric or show a bit more leg. But it's something I must wonder at the end of every show. Why don't they play you on the radio? Why don't they play you on the radio? I'm sure there's an exception to each and every rule, but perhaps I'm too political and not a useful tool to keep the music in the background and the commercials in the fore, to keep the shoppers shopping and not protesting the war, to keep the lemmings humming the same 300 songs, the songs they play throughout the year, each night and all day long. Maybe I just don't make the grade to be one of the chosen few. Perhaps there was a sign somewhere and I just missed a cue. Or I need to change my name to Bruce or Silvio. Why don't they play you on the radio? Why don't they play you on the radio? It could be I just don't have the talent that's involved. I'm lacking the commitment, I'm insufficiently resolved. Or maybe there just aren't a million people who might buy more records made by some whiny left-wing guy. Or maybe they would, but I'm just out of luck, because I don't have a label that can spend $1 million, because Sony and Clear Channel have taken over everything. And you've got to pay the piper if you want to make the piper sing, and it's the king who tells the piper where to go. Why don't they play you on the radio? Why don't they play you on the radio?
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and that was David Rovix. Tonight's show is all about Amazon, one of the biggest and most celebrated innovators of the so-called new economy. As you will hear from our guests, there's really not much new about it when it comes to work and the working conditions. They're pretty much 19th century. When Amazon announced that it was hunting for a location for a second headquarters besides Seattle, mayors across the country went berserk, including our very own, offering up subsidies and all manner of gimmicks to get Amazon's attention. Sly James spent hours rating Amazon products with as many stars as he could find, as if that would substitute for great infrastructure, good schools, and lots of computer engineers. Amidst all that, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, ILSR, produced an in-depth report. Then, ILSR and Jobs with Justice did a fact sheet that breaks down how Amazon is undermining working people and what we can do about it. Jobs with Justice, along with other organizations, then developed a wish list based on the report of things any city should want from Amazon. To tell us about the working conditions at Amazon is Sam Nelson. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Hey, Judy. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I noticed that Jobs with Justice is closed for the holidays, so thanks for staying over tonight.
Of course.
So the opening of an Amazon warehouse here in Kansas City, Kansas, recently was big news. It's our first, and according to the KCK newsletter, which arrived at my house today, the Amazon distribution facility has created thousands of new jobs and is now Wyandotte County's second largest employer after the University of Kansas Medical Center, and it has an annual payroll of about $50 million. 24,449 people applied for 5,500 jobs. If that wasn't, it was indeed popular. The city claims the pay is better than average entry-level jobs that don't require college. They have good benefits, including 95% tuition reimbursement at community college. We'll get to the subsidies later that we paid for all of these wonders. But Sam, would you tell us why we shouldn't be celebrating all this? Start with the number of jobs created.
Yeah, so often what Amazon does in their warehouses, particularly their larger ones, is that they hire a ton of people, and then they, you know, if you are lucky enough to get a directly hired position, that is, if you don't go through a temp agency, which we believe Amazon often says, we've hired this many people, when really many of them go through temp agencies, which often pay lower, and, you know, it's a much, much harder to kind of assert yourself in the workplace. The jobs themselves are, you know, they're grueling work. We've seen that there are a number of our kind of partners that there's been incredibly high turnover at Amazon warehouses, that the work is grueling, that note that, you know, Amazon pays better than the average entry-level position that doesn't require a college degree, well, those pay pretty low. And so saying Amazon pays better than them or hires more people than some of these employers is kind of, you know, saying that they're meeting the absolute minimum requirement for a decent job. And so if you consider that's 5,000 warehouse jobs that most people won't, you know, have for their entire lives, then you're kind of seeing basically a mill that churns people out as they get tired and Amazon doesn't see them as up to snuff anymore because they have such incredibly stringent, you know, surveillance within the warehouses and, you know, quotas that need to be met by the various workers.
Sounds like kind of a nightmare to me. so how do you have a formula for how many jobs we can actually expect to disappear in our community because of the penetration of Amazon into the retail sector?
That's the kind of insidious part about it is that so this wonderful report that Institute for Local Self-Reliance put out last year found that Amazon's effect on retail jobs is roughly the same as Walmart's. It's about for every job created by Amazon, two jobs are lost in you know, formula retail and brick-and-mortar retail. The issue being is that it's not one-for-one in the community. So Kansas City likely has already lost retail jobs to Amazon, but that's because of a warehouse built in, you know, Texas or in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. The warehouse in Kansas City will likely result in less retail jobs both in Missouri, but also in places like California and Illinois. They're so expansive, and because all the kind of warehouses overlap in where they deliver, it's a lot harder to pinpoint the exact kind of impact within a specific community.
Okay. And I imagine later in the show, Sean is going to go into the whole effect on, Amazon's sort of monopoly practices. But,
yeah.
You know, they said in this blurb by Reju that they have good benefits. Do they have, and they mentioned the college tuition. Do they have benefits beyond that?
They did, after a lot of pressure, cave on things like family leave that they say they offer to all of their employees. And so, you know, on paper, these things exist. Things like healthcare, things like a 401k, things like family leave. But I think a lot of other stories, not just at Amazon, but at a lot of companies, show that not a lot of people take these or actually make use of these because they're afraid of retaliation.
Oh,
and in
really?
A place like Amazon, where so much depends on time, like just-in-time delivery and things like that, I think it's worth looking at whether people feel that they're in a position to actually take advantage of these benefits that Amazon is touting, and also just how good these benefits are in practice. You can say you offer family leave, but is it guaranteed you're going to have your job at the end of it? You know, is it guaranteed that, you know, your pay won't be docked, that you will be able to still get the amount of hours that you had beforehand? So I think when Amazon says they're offering these benefits, that's fine, but really it's what these benefits look like in practice is what we need to be looking at.
You know, people are telling me that right now, even though the place just opened a couple of months ago, that the workers are working extraordinary amounts of overtime because it's Christmas season, and that people are having to run all day. Is that typical?
Oh, yes. So, and this is part of the surveillance that I mentioned earlier. So in the, you know, there's in warehouses, if you're one of the people who pick off one of the robots, because a lot of workers, they actually stand still in one place all day while a robot comes up to them, they pick something off of it, then the robot goes. Both them and then the people who actually run around picking things manually off shelves, they wear these kind of bracelets, or they have a big TV monitor above them that flashes red if they're not going what Amazon has determined the most efficient speed, and that if you continually do that, then you're reported automatically. And if you go ahead of schedule, if you're being even more efficient than what Amazon determines is efficient, then they actually add more work to you. So you, even if you can get ahead of the existing work you have, Amazon immediately puts more work on you. And so you're constantly having to pick up the slack, even if you've already gotten ahead in their terms.
So this sounds like the Japanese model of management by stress, that they always want to keep stressing the operation in order to boost productivity, and then they remove resources whenever they can in order to lower their costs. Is that what that's what their model is?
I'm not sure if it's directly coming from that, but it is the kind of 21st century version of that, where, you know, because of, you know, technology now, you can monitor individual people down to, like, the minutes required for them to go to the bathroom. So it's that, but with Amazon's kind of eye towards technology and absolute efficiency, they've almost kind of gone to the next level of kind of individually picking people and timing them down to the second and things like that. So it's the evolved version of that model of management that I think in our day and age is often normal, but Amazon takes it to, I think, particularly creepy extremes.
So how long do people typically last in a job like that?
So our research with places like Good Jobs First and Warehouse Workers for Justice and some other researchers, we found that really it varies depending on what kind of warehouse you work in. We know in some of the smaller warehouses that do the two-hour delivery that are often in the middle of cities, that the turnover rate can be as high as 100% every month.
Wow.
In the bigger warehouses like this, people typically last, you know, 3 to 6 months, maybe 6 months to a year. A friend of mine who worked for Amazon for about a year before he quit, then moved a number of years later, got another job at Amazon in the new location, and only stayed for about 6 months because he couldn't take it. So these are definitely, they just churn through people no matter where you're at, if you're one of the floor workers.
Sounds like a chicken plant.
Yeah, you're boxed in.
You mentioned temp services. Do they typically use a lot of temps?
Yes, and that's the kind of interesting thing about Amazon is that they use a number of national temp agencies, you know, like Kelly Services and such. They also use local and regional temp agencies in a lot of locations if they can't find the labor force that they need immediately, or particularly during the holidays when they hire up, you know, tens of thousands of new seasonal workers. So temps are definitely heavily a part of Amazon's model. But what's interesting is that in some places they're moving back from temps because they want to have that direct control over people. We saw in Minneapolis that they've actually moved away from temps to more direct hires of people because they value that kind of direct control over things. That's why they own their own warehouses. That's why they are trying to get into the delivery business themselves. And so they're kind of testing both to see what works best for them, whether, you know, tons of temps or tons of directly employed people. But likely if you work at an Amazon warehouse, someone next to you is a temp worker.
Okay, I want to go back to the wages for a minute because there's this chart on the website ILSR? Is that right?
Yeah.
Which compares wages in different places. And you don't have Kansas City on here, but let's just take Kenosha, Wisconsin, for instance. And you're saying that Amazon's wages are actually 22% lower than a typical warehouse worker. Is that because it's non-union?
I would say in most places, warehouse workers are non-union, particularly the kind of warehouse work that Amazon does.
Uh-huh.
And so I think, and, you know, this is kind of all over the place. You have probably an area, say, like in Inland Empire, where you might have some more unions, or Louisville, which has a lot of warehousing unions through UPS. But if you look at a place like Kenosha or Columbia, South Carolina, it's across the board kind of thing. And so we're thinking that this is probably even below non-union rates in a lot of locations, just because of how uniformly below and how relatively, you know, in line their wages are across the board between $10 and $13. Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking to Sam Nelson from Jobs with Justice and in D.C. And we've got about 5 minutes left. And so in the time we have left, Sam, can you tell us about the wish list that Jobs with Justice developed along with Partnership for Working Families and I guess a number of other organizations? And what is it and why did you do it?
Yeah, so so we developed what we call our HQ2 wish list, which you can see at ourhq2wishlist.org, basically as a response. We started doing this in the process of them gathering up the various bids by the 238 some cities and states across Canada, the United States, and Mexico that submitted bids, because we saw in the news it was all about like the jobs and, you know, everyone's fighting over it, and no one's actually talking about what kind of jobs we want, what kind of, you know, impact Amazon will actually have on our community. And so with Partnerships for Working Families, who work a lot on infrastructure, and we work a lot on, you know, kind of labor and some development work, we polled and asked a lot of our own local coalitions. Jobs with Justice has 37 across the country. Partnerships for Working Families has, you know, over a dozen affiliates. We asked our local people, like, you know, if Amazon comes to your city, which in most cases they submitted a bid, what do you want to see out of that? And so we really saw this as the kind of counterfire towards the cities just kind of getting on their knees begging Amazon to come. With a company as powerful as Amazon, you need to make demands on them. They should not be demanding things from you. And so we want to make sure that, you know, housing is going to be a major issue. We've seen Seattle affordable housing there absolutely collapse since the tech boom, Amazon being a big driver of that. Things like, you know, they always get tax abatements. Are we going to actually get money from Amazon that we can put back into the community and have actual public control over it? They are talking about a deal with a city in California that the city and Amazon jointly would decide where that money would go, which is a completely flies in the face of even minimal democracy. And so we really saw this as an opportunity to kind of hit Amazon in a way that would actually kind of diminish, that would actually, you know, hurt their image as a great company and a friendly company. Because, you know, when you move 50,000 people, many of whom will likely have to move in from out of state, and you completely kind of take over the downtown of a city, unless you have strong accountability, transparency, and, you know, communities holding that company to the fire, that company will be able to do whatever they want. And we've seen it, you know, happen with various other gigantic headquarters in, you know, Amazon in Seattle, but all the tech companies in San Francisco, or, you know, when hospitals decide to plant down somewhere. We've seen time and time again when a major company puts down and they don't have any kind of counter to what they're saying, the community always loses. And so we want to make sure that whatever community gets HQ2, that they actually can dictate to Amazon what is good for their community and what they want to see out of Amazon for that community.
Okay, well, we will put a link to the wish list and also to the report on our website so people can find out more. So I guess you're not a Prime member?
I shop from Amazon on occasion, but no, I'm not a Prime member.
And so are you encouraging people simply not to shop online?
I would say if you can find local businesses, definitely do that. But we want to talk about a larger place of where our economy is going and, you know, what Amazon is. And so we're not saying don't shop online, but what we're saying is that, you know, in ways that we think might be more effective, like, you know, preventing Amazon from building a new headquarters or organizing workers in a warehouse into a union, that these are really the things that, you know, are important. And, you know, you can almost never get enough consumers to stop buying from a company unless it's small. And with 85 million Prime subscribers, Amazon's a bit kind of beyond the pale at this point. So we're saying to support the workers and support the communities that are directly going up against Amazon.
Okay. Thank you so much. This has been Sam Nelson. I'm Judy Ansel. And we really appreciate your being on the show, Sam. And next, after a short break, Sean Savings is going to be talking to Olivia De La Vecchia, who is also who helped write this report. So stay tuned. Thanks.
Women's Agenda 21, Environmental Demands for the 21st Century, on Wings, Saturday at 2:30.
Did you know you can support any or all shows on KKFI by becoming an underwriter? Underwriting identifies your business, products, and services as supporting community radio programs, putting your enterprise in touch with the community. To learn more about supporting KKFI and spreading the word that you do, go to kkfi.org/underwriting.
Welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. Much like Walmart, the brick-and-mortar retail behemoth that preceded it, Amazon has long used its dominance in the market and communities' desperation for jobs, any jobs, to extort exorbitant sums of tax dollars out of the public coffers and onto their bottom line. But the impacts on state and local budgets aren't just limited to the tax dollars forgone or given back to the company itself. Companies like Amazon not only destroy local jobs, but also community tax bases. Much research has gone into quantifying both the direct and indirect costs companies like Amazon are having on local communities, and the good folks at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance have gathered this research into an eye-opening report entitled Amazon's Stranglehold: How the Company's Tightening Grip is Stifling Competition, Eroding Jobs, and Threatening Communities. Joining us this evening from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance is co-author of the report, Olivia La Vecchia. Ms. La Vecchia, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Did we have her?
She should be there. Oh, I guess she hung up.
Did we lose her?
Here.
All right. So. Well, let me, we're trying to get her back on the line. I'll talk a little bit about what this report has to say about it. One of the things that shocked me in this report was the extent at which Amazon's encroachment into the marketplace has expanded in just the last few years. Roughly 46%, I'd say now 50% by this year, of all retail shopping is done through Amazon. In fact, or Amazon, one of its marketplace providers, which are these third-party sellers. And roughly half of all households in the United States now have an Amazon Prime account, and 99% of those people with those Prime accounts never search for an item online outside of Amazon. In fact, Amazon has become their internet shopping. They do not search for Google to look for an item or anything. They just go straight to Amazon. This is giving Amazon an incredible market power that almost nobody has ever had before. Do we have her on the line? All right, we do have her back. Hey, hi, Olivia, you there?
Sean, hi. It's good to be here.
All right, we're back. Okay. I was just starting to talk a little bit about the size of Amazon. And before we talk about sort of about the tax, avoidance or appetite, let's talk a little bit about how big Amazon actually is, and how dominant they are now in the retail field. So what's the latest?
Yeah, that's right. You know, even if we're just looking at Amazon as a retailer, it's a company that's gotten incredibly big and with that, incredibly powerful. Today, half of all U.S. households are subscribed to Amazon Prime, which is Amazon's monthly membership program. half of all shopping searches start directly on Amazon. Amazon captures nearly one in every $2 that Americans are spending online now. And, you know, Amazon sells more books, toys, apparel, consumer electronics than any retailer, online or off. It's investing heavily in grocery. We just this year saw it buy Whole Foods. So really what we've seen is even, you know, just looking at the retail arm of this company, its market power now rivals or exceeds that of Walmart. And we see that only continuing to grow.
So do you think Amazon's fits the traditional model of a monopoly then?
It's, you know, it's a really interesting question. And I think we, when we start thinking about Amazon as a monopoly, it's also really starting to look at some of Amazon's arms that aren't just retail. Increasingly, what we see Amazon doing is rolling out other pieces of this company that are kind of aiming to control the underlying infrastructure of the economy. So actually, a lot of people don't realize this, but half of all of the sales that happen on Amazon.com aren't direct sales sold by Amazon, the retailer. They're third-party sales for other sellers who use Amazon's platform. They call it the marketplace, as a way to reach their customers. And that platform has become, you know, the dominant platform for digital commerce. Another thing is Amazon Web Services. It's a division of the company that provides cloud computing capacity, and it provides that for, you know, a lot of overall cloud computing capacity. It powers everyone from Netflix to the CIA. And just a third kind of infrastructure arm is Amazon's increasingly building out its network of warehouses, distribution centers, and doing more and more kind of logistics and delivery work.
Right.
So, you know, I think when we look at that with infrastructure, we really do see a lot of parallels to, you know, the monopolists of the Gilded Age, where they controlled the railroads. And, you know, if you were another business, you had to ride their rails in order to get your goods to market. And we're really increasingly with Amazon today seeing them controlling these platforms that other businesses have to use to compete. So I think that's one way to think about this company as a monopoly and their increasing size and power.
So much in the way that the railroads monopolies could control getting a producer's goods to market, Amazon is controlling, even though these marketplace sellers are all third-party people, they're putting strict constraints on what those folks can do through their platform, right? And so they're controlling, in fact, sometimes even stealing items or ideas from these their third-party sellers. Is that?
That's right. Absolutely. So Amazon has this conflict of interest where it's a retailer competing with these other sellers on its platform, but it also controls the platform and it has access to all of that data. There's a really interesting study that came out of Harvard Business School that finds out, or rather that found that Amazon uses that data in ways that undermine sellers on their most successful products. You know, it's also Amazon taking a 15% is usually the fee that Amazon takes, so taking that cut off the top of everyone's business. And in several other ways on that front, we see that these businesses don't really have a fair or open market in which they can compete anymore, but kind of a private arena controlled by Amazon. And you might say, okay, well, you know, there are other places they can sell online. They don't have to be sellers in the marketplace. But Amazon's platform has become so dominant online that that's really not true. You know, increasingly, if you want to sell online, Amazon and the Amazon marketplace is the way that you have to do it.
Right. So, and Wall Street investors seem to smell a monopoly. I mean, if you look at market capitalization, which is the amount of money that's invested in the stock price, basically, of a company times its number of shares, can you compare that to Walmart and the profit level of each company, yet their market, what Wall Street investors think of each company?
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing comparison. You know, Walmart has generated $80 billion in profit over 2000, the 5 years ending 2016, while Amazon cleared just a little more than $1 billion dollars, so you know, mm-hmm. significantly less.
Right.
But Amazon is valued at nearly twice as much as Walmart is. So you know, we really see it's clearly so, not
why would
Amazon's
why would investors want to do that?
That
yeah.
are
yeah why
yeah. It's well, actually, it's something we quote in our report is a high profile, you know, Silicon Valley venture capitalist who was speaking, giving a public talk about Amazon. And one of the things he said is, you know, we believe there is a multi-trillion-dollar monopoly hiding in plain sight. So Wall Street is really bankrolling Amazon's expansion with the understanding that even if they're not profitable now, later this company is going to have been able to buy so much market share that it will extract monopoly profits.
Right, and monopoly. When you have a monopoly, then prices start to rise right back up. So they Amazon might be leading on prices right now, but the minute you've got control over the market, and we've seen this happen right already, the prices have started to creep back up on items that they control when they dominate, in like say book publishing, for example.
That's right. That's right. Certainly, it's something you know we see in other sectors, and with Amazon itself, Amazon has sort of. Successfully marketed itself as always the lowest price, and we actually find that that's not true.
There's other evidence too that you say. I mean, this is and other researchers have done that come up with this as well. That these monopoly situations like this, and not just Amazon but others, are actually stifling competition. And there's some evidence for that regarding you know if you look at retail space and business startups. What does that show us?
Yeah, it's true. You know, the U.S. has this vision of itself as a nation of startups. You know, there's kind of this tech-fueled imagination. And in fact, we've seen the rate of new business formation, you know, startup businesses decline really dramatically since the 1970s, and even more so in recent years. In 2005, there were 550,000 new businesses that were created. And that number dropped to 400,000 new businesses created, you know, less than 10 years later by 2012. And there's new economic research that's coming out that is linking the rise of increasing market concentration across the economy with this decline in new business formation and also linking it with increasing levels of inequality. And that, you know, increasing levels of concentration, which, you know, what I mean when I'm saying that is just smaller and smaller numbers of bigger and bigger businesses
right.
is something that a larger economic trend that Amazon is very much a part of.
Because Amazon likes to talk about how many jobs it's created, but I mean, there's actually evidence that they've destroyed more jobs in retail.
Yeah, that's definitely what we found in our analysis. When you look at the number of people that a small independent businesses employs for every $1 million in revenue compared to the number of people that Amazon does, we found that there's a significant net loss in jobs. You know, that this is a big company, so as it grows, it is hiring people, although as Sam was talking about, these jobs are not good jobs, and a lot of that hiring happens in questionable ways, including a lot of temp work and subcontracted work. But its size kind of is a distraction from the fact that many smaller, medium-sized, even right. other you know large businesses, as those sales are shifting to Amazon, we're talking about a net loss in jobs.
Right, because you can concentrate the gain in jobs, and Amazon can say, look how many people we've hired. All those losses are distributed across the country, and each community only sees a few stores go out of business. And then the one company that gets the new Amazon warehouse goes, oh, look at all these jobs we got. But that ignores how many thousands of jobs were lost across the state of Kansas, for example, over the last few years because of Amazon.
That's right. I think that's a really key point because, you know, one of the other economic trends that we see that Amazon is very much a part of is just increasing regional inequality. And, you know, the shifting of jobs from being distributed across geography, across all places in the country mm-hmm. to just a few hubs. And what that means more and more is that there are places being left behind. You know, we're used to retail happening in the place where people live. Retail
right.
jobs are jobs that are really evenly distributed. And as Amazon is capturing, you know, an increasing share of that market now, that's no longer the case.
And as those businesses disappear, that affects the community tax base.
That's right. It does in a few ways. And just as one example, you can look at property taxes. Property taxes and commercial property taxes are the largest single source of revenue for local governments around the country. That kind of model is about having downtown locations, having businesses and retail stores occupying kind of prime locations. Amazon's model is really different. Even if it has a warehouse, it's not in that kind of same kind of high tax property area.
Yeah, walking by the warehouse.
We're very much seeing local governments starting to. Just really beginning to grapple with this, but as Amazon grows, that is a threat to tax revenues and the tax bases everywhere.
You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving, and tonight I'm talking with Olivia LaVecchia, a researcher with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, about the internet leviathan Amazon. So you've pointed out in your report that even when they add new jobs at a facility, they're not adding much to the local tax base, because in fact they're asking for a lot of tax giveaways in the first place. So, can you tell us about what have you learned about the Amazon's search for tax dollars?
Yeah, there's this common conception that Amazon has risen to the top on its own merits. And actually, a core part of this company's strategy from the very beginning has been to rely on public benefits that aren't available to its competitors, to figure out ways to game the tax system and then use that to fuel its growth. And one of the ways that we've seen Amazon do that is that when it started expanding its network of warehouses and other delivery infrastructure, it got really good at extracting public subsidies from local and state governments to fund those physical locations. The organization Good Jobs First, and along with us, has done an analysis that estimates that the total value of those subsidies that Amazon has gotten to build its warehouses is $1.1 billion. And that's a lowball estimate, because it's there's a lot that we don't know about a lot of tax incentives. And, you know, we see that playing out again right now with what's happening with the hunt for Amazon's second headquarters.
Right. The HQ2, right. So your report shows that like over half of the Amazon warehouse fulfillment centers have received tax breaks, some very large ones. There's also something about Amazon's history that uses taxes to their advantage in a different way. And that was the fact that back when they started, they did not collect, in effect, refused to collect sales taxes for years. So what do we know? I mean, that gave them a competitive advantage over a brick and mortar retailer who's got to charge sales tax. What do we know about how much money they were able to collect in that time period? I mean, what kind of economic advantage did they have?
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes it's easy to just forget how significant that is. I mean, sales tax in, we can be talking about rates of up to 10% depending on what city and state that you're in. And that's, more than many local retailers' entire margins. So Amazon getting this advantage was huge. There was a study that came out just in 2016 from Ohio State University, and it tracked spending from 275,000 households. And it found that in places where Amazon started collecting sales tax, people actually cut their spending on the site by more than 9% and by nearly 30% for more expensive items priced over $250. And so just think about that. You know, the study came out in 2016. At that stage of Amazon's growth and dominance, for sales tax to still be that significant for the company, it just makes me think about how significant it was, 20 years ago when Amazon was just starting out, too. And we don't have exact figures on how much sales tax revenue has been lost, but there are individual examples that get at, you know, kind of the collective scale of it. One is Texas at one point slapped Amazon with a bill for back sales taxes that had gone uncollected. And this was in a period that was just 2005 to 2009. So, you know, when Amazon was smaller and when e-commerce was smaller than it is today. And in that period alone, this bill was for $269 million in uncollected sales taxes.
Wow.
And I just want to give you one more example there.
Yeah, real quickly, because we are almost
Amazon
out of time.
Is now collecting sales tax on its direct sales. But like I was saying earlier, half of all transactions that happens on that happen on Amazon are sales from third-party sellers. And Amazon still does not collect sales tax on those sales.
Right.
And actually, just earlier this season, South Carolina filed a motion saying that those uncollected sales taxes added up to $500 million in lost revenue for the state over 5 years. And the state was really explicit about what's at stake with that.
I had to cut you off.
Disadvantage threatens to put compliant taxpayers out of business.
I think we are almost out of time. I appreciate this. There's a lot of information in this report. I wish we had a little more time to talk about it. But this is something we're gonna come back to here on the Heartland Labor Forum, I'm sure, more than once over the next year. But we are out of time. And thank you very much for being on the show, Ms. LaVecchia. That was Olivia LaVecchia with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. You can find a link to her report, Amazon Stranglehold, How the Company's Tightening Grip is Stifling Competition, Eroding Jobs, and Threatening Communities at heartlandlaborforum.org or on our Facebook page. Stay tuned now for Know Your Rights with Angie Williams.
Get up, stand up.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I want to talk a little bit about something that happened last week. And what can increasingly be seen as a trend in the current administration. The current administration last week rolled back yet more of the Obama administration regulations. Specifically, this time I'm talking about the National Labor Relations Board definition of the joint employer stand that the board previously had redefined in just 2015. Essentially, the joint employer comes down to how two different companies have control over employees and who in the end is going to be considered an employer if there is a problem specifically with employment conditions. The previous standard has been in place since 1984 and said that a firm or a company is a joint employer only if it exercised direct control over the employees in another business. This might include things like decisions about hiring and firing, supervisions, wages, all of that constituted direct control. In 2015, in a case called Browning Ferris Industries, however, the National Labor Relations Board created a new definition of joint employer, and this time they said a joint employer could be held responsible for employees in another business if the one employer has direct or indirect control over the employment of employees from other companies. Now, that may seem very confusing and like it's a very small difference, but the difference between direct control and indirect control hugely enlarges the standard of when, say, a contractor might be liable for the work conditions of subcontractors. So, what happened last week? In a case that related to two separate construction companies, in this case it was Hybrand Industrial Contractors and Brandt Construction, the National Labor Relations Board found that these two companies were in fact joint employers and were thus jointly liable for unlawful firing of seven workers. That seems like a good thing. However, inside this decision, they overruled their new definition of joint employer that was just created in 2015. And they did this by saying that the two construction companies were only joint employers because one of them exercised direct control over the other's employees. So in this case, it was firing. That was one of the things that was in the 1984 standard, where a direct control meant things like decisions about hiring and firing, supervision and wages and that sort. By rolling back and saying that they were only joint employers because they had direct control over it, they essentially overruled and obliterated the broader definition that was only created in 2015. This, by the way, was a 3-2 decision. Now, this new standard in 2015 was not without controversy. In fact, it was a pretty controversial decision then. Businesses that particularly franchise businesses were very upset by this new standard because it meant that franchises, like the parent company, could be responsible for something that was happened in a wholly independent franchise. But because there was a franchise-franchisee relationship, the indirect standard could apply and make a parent company actually liable for working conditions and wages and hiring and firing decisions in a franchise. Of course, for laborers, this decision is very bad news, because now it makes less causes of action and less ability to go after poor working conditions. Workers' rights groups were also upset about this latest backtracking of the joint employer rule because of the quickness in which that it has reversed decision. When you overturn precedent so quickly, it makes the law very unstable. Additionally, various interest groups are upset because the board never gave the public a chance to comment on its decision to even review these standards, and the cases that were at hand didn't bring up the standard. It dealt with something that was considered a direct control situation in the first place. So it was not a case where they were asked to even look at whether or not someone had indirect control. I feel like there's probably going to be more on this ruling and more to this issue, so I doubt this will be the last time we hear about it. That's all the time we have for tonight, folks. This is Angie Williams again with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights, saying be safe, have a happy holiday, and have a safe new year.
Now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Not much going on with the holidays, but we've got a few things that are after Christmas. And just in case Donald Trump fires Robert Mueller, there's already a rally planned to protest. And that'll be December 30th at 5 p.m., either at Liberty Memorial or at the Kansas City, Missouri Municipal Court. This will be sponsored by Indivisible, and all I can say is stay tuned on Facebook. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee, Tuesday, January 2nd, 6:30, All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut. Empower Missouri, Missouri Legislative Preview, Friday, January 5th, 8 to 10 a.m., Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral, that's downtown, 415 West 13th Street. And finally, Gerrymandering, How It Works and How It Can Affect Elections. This is sponsored by the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus. It's going to be on Tuesday, January 16th, 6 to 8 p.m. at Community Christian Church, 4601 Main Street in Kansas City. You can find our calendar, our upcoming schedule, and our archived shows on our website at heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to have Eleanor Goldfield reading poetry from her book, Paradigm Lost, which is really dynamite. And then we're going to be asking whether religious freedom can cost your job. This is going to be about Kansas, of course. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman. Happy holidays to everybody.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.